Hello, everybody. This is Grant Podolko, and you're listening to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thanks for spending a bit of your day with us. On this week's show, we bring Balkans expert Nenad Pejic back into The Blender studios to talk about why he thinks Bosnia is sliding back to square one.
Everything there has been declared as an ethnic issue. And are you smart enough? Are you educated enough? It is really not important at all.
Dmitry Kalinin, a virtuoso on the Russian balalaika, explains why this beautiful instrument was once considered a threat to church and state. And of course, we ask him to play for us. And we join the celebrations marking the 60th anniversary of the first broadcast ever made by Radio Free Europe to the people of Czechoslovakia. But first to South Asia. There's been a spate of child suicide bombings in Afghanistan and Pakistan in recent weeks, perhaps due in part to the Taliban's latest push for fresh revenge attacks after the killing of Osama bin Laden by U.S. forces last month. Afghan officials have accused the Taliban of training children for the attacks. Under closer inspection, however, the reasons why children become suicide bombers are more complex. Kristen Deasy reports.
To a growing number of children in Pakistan and Afghanistan, this is the sound that ushers in immortality. That's the sound of a suicide bomber detonating a vest of explosives in Iraq. While most people associate a bomb blast with death, one 15-year-old would-be suicide bomber says the people who pushed him to participate in a recent suicide mission described it differently.
They told us we would go to heaven. They told us how beautiful it was. And that's why I said, okay, I was deceived this one time, and I will not do it again.
This young man, who did not want to be identified, was arrested in northern Afghanistan on April 5th. Educated in a madrasa, or religious school, in the Pakistani city of Peshawar, he is charged with planning to use a suicide vest to blow up an airport in Afghanistan's northern Kunduz province. Such attacks have increased dramatically in the region in recent weeks, including a bombing attempt by a child as young as 9 and a deadly attack carried out by a 12-year-old. One top Afghan official recently accused the Taliban of recruiting children, a charge the group has denied. More than 24 would-be suicide bombers under the age of 18 years old are now in Afghan juvenile custody. Authorities recently detained some 100 boys between the ages of 12 and 17 on charges of plotting extremist acts. What drives these young people toward violence, however, is far from clear. One new study by a Pakistani university shows that economic hardship appears to contribute to suicide bombing. Peer pressure is also seen as a determining factor. Afghan officials have also recently raised concerns about the role of madrasas, particularly those in poverty-stricken Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. A recent Newsweek article details active recruiting for Islamic extremism at one large Afghan refugee camp in Pakistan known as Shamshatu. One resident, a 20-year-old who calls himself Waliullah, explains that, as he says, "The reason God brought our family to Shamshatu was that he wanted me to become a jihadi." However, the Afghan government's representative for education in Pakistan, Abdul Ghani Hidayat, calls such allegations absolutely false.
They are not taught jihad in Pakistani schools. They're under constant surveillance. There's nothing like this going on. It has not happened and will not happen. No crime such as this has happened.
Indeed, madrasas defy easy categorization. Some provide a strong liberal arts-focused education within the context of religion, earning a reputation similar to that of many Catholic parochial schools in the West. others serve as little more than a mouthpiece for violent Islamist propaganda. Mullah Ram Dad teaches in Pakistan's Deer District, which is in the restive Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. He attributes the suicide bombing narrative to the authorities.
We clerics have read about such suicide bombers, but this information came from the government. It is something the religious clerics are against. Suicide bombers are uneducated people used for such acts and should be stopped. We are against this. They are tainting the name of Islam and are not true Muslims.
Ram Dad, who spent years in Islamic studies, says he never encountered such a radical interpretation.
I studied the militant aspect of jihad for 8 years and was never told that the suicide bombings were okay. We are waiting. We learn the militant aspect of jihad, but we wait for a call from our leaders before we do anything. We should not act now. Besides, Peshawar is a land of Islam, and there is no need for jihad there.
The common belief that suicide bombers are galvanized by radical Islam has also been challenged by new studies. A 2010 book on the psychology of suicide bombing suggests that many bombers are clinically depressed and take their lives for reasons similar to people who commit other forms of suicide. Other experts, such as the political scientist Robert Pape, theorize that countries subject to foreign intervention tend to develop the societal stimulus specific to such attacks. A recent United Nations report warns that many children in Afghanistan and Pakistan are forced to carry arms or have explosives packed onto them without their knowledge. Those caught are often kept in adult prisons in poor conditions, further increasing the chances of a return to violence. 14-year-old Mohammed Farid was arrested on April 5th on charges of attempting to blow up the Kunduz airport. Despite being educated in a Pakistani madrasa, religion had nothing to do with the young Afghan's reasons for pursuing violence.
I don't have a problem with the Afghan government, but I don't like foreigners. I mastered making landmines so I could blow up their tanks.
For Farid, it's the foreigners. For others, it's the enticements of paradise. However different their reasons may be, the lives of children who turn to or are forced into terrorism all share an anguished existence that has long been ignored.
That was Kristen Deasy reporting.
You're listening to The Blender, RFERL's weekly podcast.
Last week, I sat down with Nenad Peyich, an associate director of broadcasting here at RFE, to talk about his favorite topics, Balkan history and Balkan politics. Just a few minutes after we'd finished our discussion, news broke of the capture of Bosnian Serb war crimes fugitive Ratko Mladic. So I brought Nenad back into the studio to get his expert views on the Mladic news for last week's Blender. This week, I'm pleased to present our original discussion, which I thought was just too interesting to let slip through the cracks. Before we dive into the issues, just tell us a little bit about your background and why you're writing about the Balkans.
I'm writing about Balkans because I have no other choice, because I am from Balkans. I was born in Mostar. It's a city in Bosnia, but I was working in Sarajevo TV for about 20 years or something. I was the program director of Sarajevo TV, the first ever elected, not appointed, secret ballot, and that's my part of the world. This is what I'm concerned about.
It seems to me there's a feeling among casual news junkies, at least in the West, that the problems besetting the former Yugoslavia, years of war, debilitating ethnic tensions, have largely been resolved following the Dayton Peace Accords and Kosovo's declared independence. And many of the countries in the region, Bosnia, Serbia, Montenegro, Macedonia, Croatia, are even in line for membership in the European Union. But in a recent commentary of yours that caught my attention and a lot of other people's attention, you write that, quote, Bosnia seems to be sliding back to square one. Can you elaborate on that?
If you're talking about Dayton Peace Accord, it was absolutely perfect tool for stopping the war, but absolutely imperfect tool for having a functional state. This is point one. Since all the guys, parties, ideologies that are in power today were in power before the war as well. They were elected in a really democratic elections. Funny enough, none of the elections afterwards were so democratic. And since they were elected democratically before the war, they led country to the war. Western powers wanted to make a deal, peace deal, and they didn't make a deal with the same people who led country to the war. So why these people should now create a peace? They didn't want it earlier. Why should they do it today? So they have, according to Dayton Accord, they have now the tools to block each other in any possible way. From who is going to be the chairman of the local soccer team to who is going to be prime minister. So everything there has been declared as an ethnic issue. And are you smart enough? Are you educated enough? It is really not important at all. The important is whom do you belong to and are you very close to your leadership in that particular ethnic part of Bosnia. And the hatred is in the media. The conflict is there. Everything has been blocked. And this is why I think Bosnia is back to square one.
Who are the bad guys in this scenario, or is everybody sort of acting like the bad guy?
I see no good guys there. I'm not saying that everybody shares the same level of responsibility, but I really don't see good guys there.
Anywhere?
In Bosnia, no. Even the civic society has been weakened dramatically. Nobody talks to them. You know, everything is about who is Serb, Bosniak, Muslim, or Croat. So where are the fourth number? Where are those who really don't feel being to belong any of these ethnic groups, or who belong, for instance, to Jewish or to Romas? They have not been considered. Even the, I think, Council of Europe said that the Bosnian constitution is unconstitutional because they don't give chance to anybody who is not either Serb or Muslim or Croat to be elected, for instance, for the presidency of Bosnia. You have no chance there. So there is no equal opportunities. And there is no equal opportunities because nobody is talking about civic society. Everybody is talking about ethnicity as the issue.
One of the things your commentaries are known for, in addition to their penetrating insight, of course, is the number of reader comments that they inspire, certainly on our English language website and, from what I understand, on the Balkan Service website as well. In fact, you recently wrote an entire commentary about this topic, and you said, quote, "My topics attract an audience that knows how to speak but is incapable of listening."
That's correct. They don't listen to each other. 24 hours ago, the President of Republic Srpska participated in a roundtable discussion in Banja Luka, and he said, actually I cannot quote him, but he explained, quote-unquote, justified genocide in Srebrenica by genocide that was done against Serbs during the in Croatia during the Nazism. And he said that 700,000 Serbs were killed in Nazi camp in Croatia. First of all, there are names of 100,000 people killed, 96,000 people killed. That is the first fact. But Grant, let me know what Muslims in Bosnia had to do with Serbs in Croatia. And how you can present this as a revenge? In Croatia, Nazis, Croat, killed Serbs. In Bosnia, Serbs killed Muslims. So how you can justify any kind of crime at all? But okay, how you can explain genocide in Srebrenica by killing in Croatia that happened 60 years ago? It means if we start to fight each other, you are going to hit and to beat our technician. This is ridiculous. But what is the point? The point is that these messages have been sent out from day to day, from hour to hour, and now it's in the consciousness of the people. Today I got a comment on my blog on the Balkan Service saying, well, yes, Serbian TV excuse for propaganda, but they are good guys, but why Croats didn't ask for excuse? Of course, Croatian TV should ask for excuse as well, but we are talking about Serbian TV that admitted propaganda going to the war and during the wartime. a colleague of mine. She had a nice expression. And because I keep telling in my commentaries that we, from ex-Yugoslavia, Balkan citizens, we keep behaving like we belong to a pen. You know, we have a pen leader, we have a big sheep, you know, and who kind of decides who is gonna do what and where you're going to sheep, where you're going to eat grass, etc. My colleague said, yes, I'm in my pen. It smells, but it's warm.
Well, Nenad, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for being on The Blender.
You're welcome.
And if you want to read Nenad's commentaries in English, you can find them on referl.org.
Говорить Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنی.
Машал Радіо Дамілі
Азатун ДТМ.
Радіо Азатун.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
On a different beat, we explore the vibrant musical traditions of RFERL's broadcast countries. On this week's show, Dmitry Kalinin shares his passion for the Russian folk instrument known as the balalaika, which is increasingly being incorporated into classical, contemporary, and jazz music. The 33-year-old Kalinin has become one of the most well-known balalaika players in Russia, performing as a soloist at Moscow's Bolshoi Theater and the Great Hall of the Moscow Conservatory, and on the soundtracks to many Russian films. Ron Sinovitz sat down with Kalinin in Prague as he was on a Central European tour.
Welcome to A Different Beat. We're here today with Dmitry Kalinin, and he is a virtuoso of a Russian instrument called balalaika.
Balalaika.
The balalaika is a three-stringed instrument, a lute, with a triangular-shaped body, three-sided. Dmitry, can you please tell us about the history of this instrument? Where did it come from? How did it develop?
This instrument is a national folk ancient instrument. First, on this instrument played street musicians in Italian, troubadour in France. In Russia, they call this skamarochi.
The balalaika is seen primarily as a folk instrument, but you have a vision for this instrument that's extending its use beyond folk music and street music. You're performing with full symphonies, you're performing with instruments from other cultures, from Japan, for example. Could you tell us about your vision?
Of course, balalaika has deep roots in our history. And now it developed, and musicians became more skillful to play this instrument, and technical possibilities grown to jazz music, to classical music, and music which is by contemporary composers, especially for this instrument. Some classical. Some variation of this Paganini theme, for example.
Would you be able to show us a small sample of a Russian folk song?
Of course, the most popular Russian folk song.
I see when you're strumming this instrument, you're not just strumming a full closed hand, but each finger individually is hitting the strings one at a time.
We have variation of how we use the string, how we play. For example, the most easiest way. That way. Tremolo. And... or... vibrato. Or... and...
now, this is a smaller balalaika.
The name is Balalaika Prima. Also, we have used in orchestra performances. A Balalaika Secunda, it's a little bigger, and it sounds a little bit lower. Balalaika Alt, bigger, lower. Balalaika Bass, and Balalaika Contrabass. It's really big balalaika, and musician played standing, and this instrument positioned on the floor. Also, we have Russian folk instrument Domra. It just looks like balalaika, but with a round body.
Let's talk about the tuning for this instrument. Is there something that purists of balalaika would argue for more traditional tuning?
We haven't, because in every village 100 years ago, they tuned as they wish, major or minor. It depends on how it was suitable for performer. But now, in our contemporary age, with professional playing on this instrument, we have tuning EEA. We have three strings, and two of them tuned as ye, ye, e, e, and one, a.
So the tuning with the tonic and the subdominant.
It concerns the interval and tonality.
In the history of the balalaika, at some times this instrument was banned from the church and by the state. Can you explain to me the history of that?
Russian Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich, Alexei Silent, in 1649, gave an order to gather all the Russian folk instruments, including domras, balalaikas, and woodwind instruments, and took them to the Moscow River and burned it, because Russian people, instead of going to church and praying there, they go to streets, dancing and drinking and having fun with that musicians, skomorochs. They won't go to church, and they... Tsar and the church decided with this way get rid of Russian folk instruments. But fortunately, they are not succeeded.
So the music itself, the instruments and the music were seen as a threat to both the church and the state. Is there something in the history of this music which also was seen as subversive to the interests of the state or to the church, other than the fact that people were celebrating and not going to church?
Really, in this century, the music just gathered people, gathered nations, make peace. Of course, classical musicians, performers on folk instruments, no matter balalaika or mandolina or bayan accordion, we just propose peace and beauty and harmony. So we couldn't spoil something, really.
You can watch a couple of videos of Dmitry Kalinin really shredding on the balalaika in our studios here in Prague by visiting the Blender blog at rferl.org. Docela všední, obyčejný den, k večeru o půl šesté. Ulice hoří do tmy neonem. On July 4th, 1950, Radio Free Europe went on the air with its first broadcast service. The target country was Czechoslovakia. The 60th anniversary of RFE has been commemorated over the past year with events in Munich, our original headquarters city, in Prague, our current home, and in Washington, D.C. In this report, Charles Recknagel recounts the storied history of the Czech service, which reads like a Cold War spy novel.
That is the sound of Radio Free Europe's Czechoslovak service. It was the first of a string of new stations that would begin broadcasting into Soviet-occupied Central Europe after World War II. The station's first broadcast was on July 4, 1950, from an office in the Empire State Building in New York City. The shortwave station signed on with the pledge of delivering news in the American tradition of free speech. Within less than a year, the station had moved to Munich, where it began beaming regular programs across the Iron Curtain. On May 1, 1951, in the first official transmission from Munich, Czech journalist Ferdinand Perotka began by saying, "This is the voice of a free Czechoslovakia," and then uttered these prophetic words.
One free radio station in a dictatorship means a revolution.
The programs challenged the communist government's monopoly on the media and its myth of delivering a better life while depriving people of their freedom.
True, they will have all the weapons and all kinds of police forces, and we shall have the medium of the spoken word. But even though all of the material superiority is on their side, they remain uneasy.
In the early years, the Czechoslovak and other incipient broadcast services of Radio Free Europe did not just use shortwave. They also floated small helium balloons loaded with news reports eastward across the German-Czech border. But it was the voice of the station's broadcasters, many of them respected émigrés who had fled Czechoslovakia's communist coup in 1948, which won a devoted audience. Pavel Pehacek was the director of the Czechoslovak service at the time of the Velvet Revolution in 1989. He says listeners took grave personal risks to tune in to the radio.
The listeners were very brave. If caught, they were punished, mainly in the cases where they were spreading RFERL news. There were cases of imprisonment. Children of dissidents couldn't attend high schools and universities. People lost their jobs.
The Czechoslovak regime did not just try to punish listeners and jam broadcasts. It also tried to strike out at the station in Munich. From 1972 to 1976, the communist regime in Prague infiltrated the Czechoslovak service with an agent from its intelligence organization. The agent, Pavel Minarek, worked as a broadcaster while trying to collect information about the station's work with informants in Czechoslovakia. Upon his return to Prague, the regime feted him as a hero while cracking down on those he betrayed. The Czechoslovak regime even composed an anthem in Minarek's honor. The song, titled Statečný chlapek, or Brave Lad, included this chorus. Thank you, thank you, brave lad, for your courage, brains, and brawn. You are our captain. They are useless. You have opened cerulean skies for the wings of peace.
Oni jsou zbyteční, přidal jste blanketu do křídel.
Since the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic ended in 1989, much more has been learned about Minarek's spying activities, including his proposals to bomb the Munich station and to abduct Pehacek and his son. Minarek's proposals were rejected in Prague, but in 1981, a bomb was placed outside the Czechoslovak section at the U.S. Foreign Broadcasting Building in Munich. The building was home both to Radio Free Europe, broadcasting to Central Europe, and Radio Liberty, broadcasting to the Soviet Union. The bombing gravely wounded three employees and caused $2 million in damage. It was ordered by Romanian leader Nicolae Ceaușescu and carried out by terrorist Carlos the Jackal. But if the bomb's objective was to cow any of the radio stations into silence, it failed. Many people during this year's commemorative events have paid tribute to the determination of the Czechoslovak service's broadcasters to challenge totalitarianism. But the greatest tribute of all was the Czech Republic's decision to welcome RFERL in 1995 to its current home in Prague. Former Czech President Václav Havel summed up his country's feelings in a message he sent for this year's anniversary. It was with great satisfaction that we could welcome RFE in Prague after the fall of the Iron Curtain and thus start to repay our debt for its credible work, he wrote.
That was Charles Recknagel reporting. Radio Free Europe continued broadcasting in Czech until 2002 and in Slovak until 2004. And that's all for this week. Thanks to Tanya Kancheva, the tireless producer of The Blender, and to videographer Ahmed Vadiyeh and regular podcast host Pavel Butorin for setting up and filming our interview with Dmitry Kalinin. We leave you with a bit more of Dmitry Kalinin playing the Russian folk song called Midges in the Forest. As always, thank you for turning on The Blender. I'm Grant Padalko. We'll see you here again next week.